Thank you for joining me. I am Brett Kelly, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, go ahead and follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod, over on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or you can support the show on Patreon if you'd like at patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. Along with our generous patrons, Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robin, and John. If you're interested in showing off your support for the show in a different way, or potentially sporting a piece of apparel that shows off your favorite fish species, you can check out our merch over at the Fisheries Podcast Fan Shop, hosted by Teespring, where you can find t-shirts, hats, stickers, masks, and much more. So please look for those links in the show notes below. But as for today, I am super excited to talk with Dr. Mark Kamick. Mark received his PhD in fisheries science from South Dakota State University, his master's in conservation biology from Central Michigan University, and a bachelor's in wildlife and fisheries sciences from South Dakota State University as well. He held a National Science Foundation postdoctoral fellowship in biology, working in New Zealand at the Victoria University Coastal Ecology Laboratory. Mark was a research assistant professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln prior to joining the Department of Biology at the University of North Dakota as an assistant professor of aquatic ecology. Mark grew up in South Central South Dakota along the Missouri River, where he developed a passion for conserving and managing natural resources. Overall, Mark aims to improve the management and conservation of aquatic systems by challenging long-standing paradigms and educating future ecologists. His integrated education and research program requires cross-disciplinary collaborations and novel approaches, and Mark's goal is to understand and share how cross-scale, spatial, and temporal processes interact to shape fish communities, fishing groups, and their environments. Without any further ado, I'd like to welcome Mark to the Fisheries Podcast. Thanks for coming on and being a guest today.
Thanks, Brett. I'm excited to be here, and it's an honor.
Yeah, so I guess before we, you know, dive into your fisheries research, I'd maybe love to hear about your upbringing along the Missouri River. I always like to start with folks' backstories, or their headwaters, as I like to put it, and how that shaped your career path. You know, were you boating up and down the river, chasing fish with a fishing rod in hand, or was there maybe a family vacation that you always went on? How did it all start for you?
Yeah, so I was pretty fortunate to grow up in a small town where natural resources were very important, and there was many instances that, you know, I kind of took for granted growing up. So one of those is being, you know, in close proximity to the Missouri River, and taking frequent fishing trips with my dad. And then once my grandpa retired from farming, he joined us on those fishing trips. So there were so many great memories of us targeting walleye and just having a great time out on the reservoir there. And then the other thing, you know, noteworthy growing up that I kind of took for granted was pheasant hunting. And I thought, you know, everywhere had great pheasant populations. I was pretty naive as a kid, you know, looking back on it. And it wasn't until I got on a plane, I think I was sixth, seventh grade, and sat next to a gentleman from Texas. And we were chatting about things, and he asked me where I was from. And I said, South Dakota. And he said, oh man, I take a trip every year up there to chase pheasants. And it was kind of that point in time where I realized we had very special opportunities growing up. And so I always wanted to do something in the natural resources. And at that time, I didn't know if it was fisheries or wildlife.
Nice. Yeah, definitely. I feel the same way a lot of times. And I look back on some of the sampling I was able to do.
You know, you don't realize, I guess, the opportunities that you have until you start moving around the country and realizing, you know, the pros and cons of living in different places and the access to some of those resources that you really value.
Yeah, absolutely. One good thing about traveling is that, you know, you see some different stuff, but there are many times where I kind of long for getting back to some of the sampling that I started off my fisheries career with. But I guess based on your bio, I believe you're relatively new to the University of North Dakota. I could be wrong about that. So first off, congratulations on that new position.
Thanks. Yeah, appreciate it. I just started the position this fall, so.
Nice. And I guess so you might have a little bit of time at the university, but I'm sure there was something about the area or the job that drew you in. So what are some of the things that you're looking forward to do in your new position or in your new, study sites or area?
Yeah, so when the position was advertised, it's pretty rare to have faculty positions to begin with. And so having one that was advertised close to where I grew up was super exciting. Obviously, I'm biased and I love the Dakotas, have many fond memories of, recreating and experiencing the outdoors in this area. And so that was certainly appealing. And then I also noticed something that very interesting that was different from a lot of the other programs around the country, and that it was a biology department that had a wildlife and fisheries program nested within the department. And typically that's not the case at research universities where they have two different departments, so natural resources and then a biology or a school of biological sciences. And so it was super exciting to see, opportunities there to sort of leverage cultures from both the natural resources and biology departments to train students. So that was something that was certainly appealing to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like you said, great to get back to the Dakotas. And your bio mentions that you're one of the things you're passionate about is, training future ecologists. And obviously teaching classes is one way to do that. So, what classes will you be teaching while you're at the university or potentially what classes will you be looking forward to develop, maybe some things that they haven't offered previously, something like that.
Yeah, so I'm fortunate to teach some amazing classes. And so one that I'm teaching right now is Human Dimensions of Fisheries and Wildlife. And so really talking and discussing about some of the complex problems facing the natural resources and how students that enter the profession, 90% of their job will be dealing with people and not the critters or the animals themselves. And so we've been having a lot of fun in the class so far. Last semester, I was able to teach ichthyology, another great course, and then two other courses that I'll get to teach next year, likely as aquatic ecology and then fisheries management. And so these are all, super exciting courses that I have a passion for. And I think the students really enjoy taking those very hands-on courses.
Yeah, that's great. I took Human Dimensions the first time that it had been offered in quite some time, my senior year at Clemson, and I am definitely glad that I did because she put us through lots of interesting stakeholder groups, sort of debates and things that, like you said, you're going to have to be able to navigate conversations about regulations or other things once you get into the field. So that's definitely a course that I think most people, I don't want to say most, but maybe some students would glaze over or maybe think that it's not as attractive as your fisheries management and the labs where you get out on the boat, but
For sure. And I'll admit as a student, that wasn't, the highest priority or class on my list. But after, experiencing the profession a bit more, growing a bit wiser, you recognize the importance and leaving humans out of the equation is it's just not going to cut it.
so are you having to adapt these new courses that you're teaching to a virtual format? I mean, granted, 2020, that was pretty much the status quo, although I think some universities were able to remain in the classroom for the fall semester, depending on, the university. So what's your experience been so far?
Yeah, and so kind of to back up and to provide some context, I was just hired on starting this fall. And so going into, starting a new job here and teaching a course right off the bat, I was super nervous on how that was going to play out. And so at the time, the university was attempting or was going to sort of leave it in the hands of the faculty members and if we could do it safely. But at any point in time, they could have pulled the plug and said, we're going to go remote entirely. And so developing, ichthyology, which is a very hands-on, lab intensive course, I was sort of wrestling with, what are my options if we go remote? And so thankfully, long story short, we were able to stay in class and meet face to face throughout the entire semester. So it's an upper level course and small enough, and we had a large enough room that we could all safely meet. And so I was very fortunate that we were able to do that. And same goes for this semester. And so we're all able to meet in a large lecture hall and still carry out the face-to-face component.
I think for the students, ichthyology is already difficult. Having to do it online, I think, would be really challenging. I know for myself anyways, I just from stream sampling, non-game stuff, it's so helpful to have those individuals up close and personal, counting scales, doing whatever else you got to do. So that's lucky for them.
Exactly. I was kind of panicking and didn't have anything figured out. So super thankful that we could meet safely in person, and it all went great. And I received some really good feedback. So
nice. Well, will you be, building a lab with students that you're advising, maybe graduate or undergraduate research or otherwise? Do they give you some freedom, or I guess, is there a program for undergraduate students to maybe pursue that type of stuff?
Yeah. Yep. So we have both, master's and PhD degrees in biology. So I'll be looking to build a lab that, involves both graduate and undergraduate students. And I'll be starting a student next fall. So I'm super excited about that. And so, and hopefully, beginning more projects in the following semester or in the following years. And so there'll be hopefully lots of opportunities for students to gain some experience and to prepare them for a career in the aquatic or fishery sciences.
Well, that's great. We'll definitely have to tune in to updates that are coming out of your lab, and I'm sure you're excited to get that ball rolling and see what 2021 is all about. I know we just recorded an episode recently about, now that we're in a new year, what are the, different co-hosts of the show kind of excited about professionally or just personally. So it's always that time of year where folks like to look forward instead of behind us, and I don't think anyone's gonna miss looking behind us here recently. It's been tough for a lot of folks, so I'm sure 2021 is looking bright for a lot of people. So
yeah, definitely. No, and it wasn't, I had kind of a mental thought or hopes of what I would accomplish here once I gotten into the job, and then with COVID a lot of that went out the window. And so but I've been trying to have set up a lot of Zoom meetings where those would have been face-to-face and sort of collaboration, getting some ideas, bouncing around those ideas. And hopefully, we'll get some projects off the ground, even despite, some of the COVID interruptions.
I guess I was originally introduced to you and your work at Iowa American Fisheries Society conference maybe 2 years ago now. It's honestly hard to remember, but
yeah,
you were still at the University of Nebraska at that time, and I think you presented presentation potentially with a creel data set.
Yep, Angler. I think if I recall, it's been a few years ago, but it was looking at how resources are distributed and how some systems might be favored over others, and particularly on ecosystem size, if I recall. And so we're docked and where anglers fishing.
Right. So I guess while you were at the University of Nebraska, now how long were you there?
So I started in 2016. So I think I was there for a little over 4 years. It was a good run.
For sure. And I guess what was the main focus of your research while you were at the University of Nebraska?
Yeah, so that was kind of a really big turning point in my career where I started to realize the value or appreciate viewing fish as part of a larger social ecological system. And so I was in charge of coordinating a statewide creel program. And so Nebraska Game and Parks had sort of contracted or worked with the university to centralize their creel program. So we would collect statewide information. So I would hire people, hire creel clerks to go out and collect the angler behavior data. And so I really got immersed in sort of some of the social components of fisheries and really developed an appreciation for anglers and understanding their behavior and how they interact with fish populations and how those fish populations respond. And so this was kind of a a really, you know, new area of research for me. And so I had a lot of work to do catching up on the recent literature and just basically rethinking a lot of things that I had previously held to be true. And it was a really exciting time. And I got to co-advise graduate students with another faculty member there. And so just, yeah, it was a wonderful experience. And they had a great team, both with working with Game and Parks Commission there and that also at the university.
You know, I don't know if folks really, you know, kind of understand, you know, fisheries in Nebraska, but for those folks that are in the Midwest, it's definitely a great program and you know, studies and work coming out of that area are held in high regard. What's maybe something that people get wrong about Nebraska or the outdoor opportunities that Nebraska has to offer?
Yeah, I think, you know, Nebraska can get a bad rap and sort of the, and many may think of it as lacking resources, but there's a tremendous amount of resources there. And there's this gradient from going from the west end of the state to the east and very different diverse landscapes. You've got out in the west some big reservoirs that produce some amazing walleye, great walleye fisheries, white bass fisheries. And then you've got the sand hills, which is a beautiful place. And that's the kind of north central part of the state. Great yellow perch, bluegill, northern pike fishing. And then the southeast and eastern part of the state, there's a lot of different reservoirs that are scattered about that region. And so I think, yeah, it's overlooked in many respects, but there's a tremendous, tremendous resources there, and they're managed really, really well. And so Nebraska Game and Parks Commission does a great job of funding research and also providing their employees, you know, opportunities to grow and also to really enhance those fisheries for the anglers.
Yeah, as someone who studied trout in Iowa, I feel you.
yes, I think Iowa
often overlooked.
Yeah, and so you kind of got the same impression living in Iowa.
Yeah, for sure. It's I remember vividly, actually, the first week that I moved to start my position there was actually the Iowa State Fair, and so. My parents had come to town to help me move out because, like I was saying, I graduated from Clemson but a few months prior to that, and so it was quite a big move. It's about 1,000 or 1,100 miles from where I currently was, and so we went down to the fair, and the Iowa Department of Natural Resources has a tent is a bad word for it, but it's a large like open air brick structure. Yep. Where they have tons of, you know, educational resources for folks that are coming to the fair, and they have fish tanks within that structure. And, you know, one of them was talking about trout, and it actually had some trout that they had brought down from northeastern Iowa. And I can't tell you how many folks that walked by the tanks were like, trout? Do we even have trout in Iowa? And I was like, oh man, you know, I'm trying to bite my tongue. Like that, I just moved here to study these things up in Northeast Iowa. So even folks that are, you know, residents of the state, sometimes
Definitely.
That northeastern corner can really get overlooked.
Yeah, that's
it's
a beautiful part of
sure.
the state.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess while you were there, and maybe this was, we sort of touched on it already in what, a part of what you were presenting on at that AFS conference, but was there maybe a particular project or a manuscript that you were able to publish while you were there that you sort of felt like you had ownership of, or maybe it was your sort of study design, or maybe something that you'd like to hang your hat on from your time at the university?
Yeah. And so I guess I would describe, you know, like many, you know, faculty positions or roles where you might have your own line of research, and then you also have a line that's a little bit directed more at graduate student training. And so one of the projects that I was sort of able to direct myself and didn't have any involvement with graduate students was looking at how anglers, angler behavior could be synchronized. And no one had ever really looked at that. So a lot of fish populations or fish studies have looked at fish population synchronizing or more in the ecological realm. And so I thought, well, hey, you know, we could look at this in terms of angler behavior to see if there is any synchrony in how anglers in how they exerted effort or their fishing behavior. And so that was one of the first projects that I started there. And it was a super fun project that was eventually published in the Journal of Applied Ecology, which is a pretty broad, prestigious journal that I was super excited to publish those results in. And we've gotten a lot of good feedback, and really people were intrigued by our findings. And some of that set up then future projects looking at ecosystem size and how that might be an important predictor of some of these patterns in these complex systems. So super fun project that led to, as good research usually does, to more, you know, other questions.
Yeah, that sounds like amazing research, especially if you can find something in fisheries science where, you know, maybe questions that folks haven't looked at before, you know, trying to always push that, you know, leading edge of new stuff that's going on is, I mean, that's hard to do these days. And I'm assuming it's always hard to do, but, you know, that's definitely something to be proud of, that you kind of carved out a unique, you know, research project that most people wouldn't have thought about. So.
Definitely. And I guess it was kind of my training and interest in ecology and kind of looking through that ecological lens on how we can take ecological theory and tools and apply them to social ecological systems like fisheries.
Certainly. And I guess if folks wanted to, you know, dive into that manuscript, you know, how can people maybe access that paper?
Yeah, so you can go onto my Google Scholar account and find the link there. And if you can't access it, if you don't have a subscription, please send me an email. I'd be more than happy to pass it along.
Cool. Yeah, well, I'll definitely put a link to your Google Scholar profile in the show notes.
Definitely.
As I mentioned in your bio earlier, you've been doing research for quite some time, even before you were at the University of Nebraska, and you received your PhD from SDSU in fishery science. So maybe what were some of the elements of your dissertation research or some of the main things that you guys were focused on there?
Yeah. And so we'll actually go back to Nebraska for that. And so I do want to put in a plug or a thank you to Nebraska Game and Parks Commission, because they funded my PhD research when I was at South Dakota State. So I've got a great relationship and owe them a lot for the experience and the training that I've received. And so part of one of the emphasis of my PhD project was to look at recruitment of yellow perch and bluegill in the Nebraska Sandhill Lakes. And so there was questions about trying to understand or predict, you know, population dynamics. And the thought there was, as we know with fish, a lot of the dynamics are kind of set in motion early on in life. And so I studied the larval and juvenile and how those stages sort of dictated the adult population. And so one of the things that when I went into that study or my PhD project, I sort of thought of yellow perch and bluegill being, you know, distinct, separate species, and that factors affecting their recruitment were very different. And so it soon, and this was guided by literature as well, and I didn't see any literature noting that there'd be any interactions or competition between these species. And what I ended up finding was that there was a lot more interaction between these two species than previously thought, and that these interactions were quite dynamic and quite complex, and it depended on the life stage, and there wasn't a clear winner or loser. In some ways, bluegill benefited over yellow perch and vice versa. So it was really exciting to see how these two species that are commonly, you know, held in high regard from the sport fish standpoint or anglers, but that there was some dynamics that were shaping or interactions that were shaping their populations.
Well, that definitely sounds like cool research. And I think it's even more important because oftentimes maybe those are species that get commonly stocked in, you know, lowland reservoirs or just like common, maybe urban fisheries or something like that, but maybe those are managed for folks to, you know, have a good time, bring their families, and easily accessible locations, catch some fish. But maybe the under sort of valued side of that is that just because you might have some of these systems that are heavily stocked or, you know, managed as put and takes or however, you know, they're managed, there is still those ecological like processes that are going on behind the scenes that maybe don't get as much attention. So that's cool that you found like really complex relationships between two common sport fishes, as you said.
Yeah, and it was a fun surprise in the fact that, you know, very few or if any other studies documented these dynamics. And so that was a fun discovery that I did not intend, you know, finding or expected to find. And the other exciting part of my PhD, it was a 10-year project, which was amazing. And so I came in on the 5 years, the back half of the project, so I could start seeing these patterns come together. And having 10 years of data was just amazing to look at these things through time and how, you know, cohorts would change and respond to different abiotic, biotic stressors. And the most exciting part was watching some of the technicians that I got to work with watch their careers develop. And so one of them actually ended up in New Zealand and has a full-time job there, and others are working for state and federal agencies. So it was super fun to see the investment that Nebraska Game and Parks Commission had on that project, not only the research side, but also the training and opportunities it provided to all those students.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm very early into my career, but it's always really neat to see, you know, how my technicians are on Facebook getting the new position or moving into, you know, bigger and better things, or maybe getting a call about a recommendation. Those are all things that at the end of the day, you can really feel good about, and that you in some way, shape or form, maybe had a big or small hand in that process. So that can be really rewarding, I'm sure.
Definitely. Yeah. And that's the most fun aspect of it all. And the research is great, but watching, you know, how that research transforms lives is just super exciting.
So sort of along the same lines, a lot of our listeners are graduate students in fisheries or potentially undergraduate students who like to listen to the podcast to get ideas about, you know, what are some potential avenues that they could go on and pursue. And one of the biggest things that, you know, lots of undergraduate students are interested in, and increasingly so seems like, is graduate school. And so given that, you know, you seem to have a passion for mentoring and you've been through the ringer, you know, you hold two graduate degrees, is there any maybe advice that you could maybe lend to those that are maybe on the fence or are heavily considering graduate school, stuff that you wish you knew before you went potentially?
Yeah, definitely. So I've given this a lot of thought, both as a graduate student myself and now on the other side of that equation, as a mentor and advisor. And my advice would be to think a lot about graduate school before diving in. And so it's a wonderful experience. But think, you know, long and hard whether or not you're going to need that degree for the career path that you want. And if the answer is yes, then I would really, you know, spend a lot of time focusing on finding an excellent advisor that has a great reputation and a project that interests you. And so if you can find a great advisor and a project that interests you, the rest, you know, will play out. But what I've found is that we're really products of our past. And so these decisions will impact your entire career. And so, again, not to overthink these things, but I think a lot of students tend to just apply to any and all programs with the hopes of getting in. But really narrowing and being strategic about that and identifying, you know, someone with a great reputation and also a project that interests you that will motivate you to finish. You know, there's a lot of things about graduate school that aren't so sexy, you know, so to speak. And you're really going to have a lot of grit and motivation to get through it. And so these choices will essentially open and close doors for you in the future. And so once you've sort of made that choice, then I think it's important to sit down with your advisor. And once you've accepted the position, and kind of create a roadmap that's tailored toward your specific goals and in your career, and then kind of set the expectations and timelines to sort of complete those things that are going to be most meaningful and valuable. But I could spend a lot of time, and I really, really appreciated graduate school and that experience. And so, you know, my hope is to be the best mentor that I can be and provide these students with opportunities to succeed.
That is some fantastic advice. I could not agree more. And like I said, I'm very early into my career, but I've had some folks that I've met across the years, you know, undergraduate students that maybe did some sampling or the AFS subunit, you know, stuff like that. Ask me my advice. And
I guess, you know, so what was were your expectations met on? I think a lot of students coming in have this idea of what graduate school looks like. And once they get there, it's not quite what they expected. And was that the same for you, or did you have a good idea of what you were in for?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'd say one thing that I was maybe surprised about is sort of the autonomy, and this, as you like, goes back to what you said, it's probably going to vary with your advisor or your project, because maybe some projects are very stakeholder driven, like the person or entity that's paying for the project has an idea of like, okay, this is exactly what, you know, you're going to do. But being a 22-year-old individual and, you know, thinking of having the autonomy to, oh, I can, you know, kind of have a lot of leeway in study design, and this is going to impact everything down the road for this project. It was, I guess I maybe right at the beginning felt a little bit, you know, in over my head type of stuff. That was the only thing right off the bat where I was like, oh, wow, you really do kind of have, you know, a lot of leeway
freedom
and some things like that. Yeah. And I'd say another good thing is that people are so much more willing to help than people think. And I'm lumped into that too, in that there was always someone in the department, whether it be a professor who's never met you before, but potentially you read, you know, one of their course descriptions or some of their papers, or there was another graduate student that had already been there for multiple years that had taken classes that you're like, okay, well, I need to figure out how to do, you know, random site selection in GIS, or I need to figure out how to, you know, script this in R. And at Iowa State anyways, there was always someone in the department who'd be willing to sit down and spend 30 minutes, an hour, you know, talking to you and teaching you how to do these things. And so on the reverse side of that, one thing I like to tell people is that you don't have to be an expert in everything that you expect to do while you're in school, because you're there to be a student. It obviously helps to have a familiarity with things, but in my opinion, graduate school should be mutually beneficial for both interested folks, and you should learn lots of things while you're there. So it was amazing to have folks at Iowa State be willing to, you know, reach out or like sit down with you and teach you things, because, you know, ultimately that's what you're there to ask questions. You're there to critically think about these things and learn a lot.
Yeah, good. No, that's the way it should be.
And like you said, it is one of those things that folks definitely should think about, and, you know, do you need it? Do you not? And who is the advisor? Or are you just sending out blanket emails to an entire department hoping to strike bullseye on something? And yeah, like I said, I think you gave some great advice and we all appreciate it. And so I guess moving forward, it was pretty awesome to see, you know, what you've been up to in the past. And I appreciate you describing all the various projects they've been working in. And like I said earlier, it's impossible to get into all the details and all the stuff that you've done. But your bio also mentioned that you spent some time in New Zealand. And so I was just curious, you know, when you were doing your postdoc, you know, what was that experience like? Had you been there previous? Had you, you know, heard a lot about the area? How did you get hooked up with that job?
Yeah, so that was an interesting turn of events. And so I really wanted to do a postdoc, or was excited about, you know, the possibility of spending a couple years dedicated to a project. And so it became obvious after my PhD that was something, you know, on the horizon. And so it sort of happened. My wife and I were talking about different places and opportunities that might exist. And she kind of threw out there and said, "Hey, have you ever thought about living abroad?" And that wasn't something that I really considered. And so I started to look for opportunities that were primarily in English-speaking countries, given that I didn't want another challenge on top of, you know, living in another country in itself. Right. And so I started to search, you know, websites and look for professors that were doing exciting work. And so I sent a few emails out, primarily in Australia and New Zealand. I've always had an interest in going there, had never been before, but thought it'd be fun to spend a couple years, you know, working in those environments. And so I didn't hear back from many. There was, I think, only one person from Australia, if I recall, and then one from New Zealand. And so the professor from New Zealand said, "Hey, you know, I'd love to work with you, but I don't have any funding." And which is a common case, especially for postdocs. They cost a lot of money, and so to support them can be a challenge. So long story short, we decided to apply for an NSF, National Science Foundation, postdoc. And so at the time, they had an RFP for working on really any area in biology. And so the topic was kind of wide open. And there was a fish down there that honestly I'd never heard of before, but it was super fascinating and had an amazing life history. And so we started to develop a proposal centered on that fish. And so I guess, yeah, long story short, ended up getting the grant and moved down there and was stationed at their laboratory right on the coast. And I had an amazing view of the ocean, and we lived right on the coast, and it wasn't unusual to see dolphins swimming by and the occasional orca. So it was a tremendous opportunity to hang out in an amazing lab and learn from some marine ecologists.
So basically it was horrible, right? I mean, that sounds
absolutely
like such a bad time and a horrible area.
it was tremendous. In fact, on a personal note, our first child was born there. So Xander, in about year and a half into my postdoc, Xander was born. And so we had, it was just a tremendous experience. We've got a lot of great friends that still live there. And so hopefully one day we can bring Xander back to show him where he was born.
Yeah, and that would be, I think, really cool for him, obviously. And very appropriately named for
us. Yes. A great name, and funny. My wife even supported it. So,
well, that's good. That's good. Well, you know, like I said, those experiences all sound awesome, and I'm sure I could spend multiple hours talking about it. But one thing that I really like to do with guests, especially that have had, you know, lots of research experience and sort of have an idea of their career moving forward, you know, people that are established in what they're doing. I love to pick their brains on sort of like some big picture type of stuff, you know, like the grand scheme of things. And so, you know, your bio mentions that, you know, your aim is to improve the management and conservation of aquatic systems by challenging longstanding paradigms. Maybe what are some of the paradigms that you would like to see challenged?
Yeah, and I guess, you know, one thing I've noticed working in different labs or on different projects and moving around and working on different systems. So when I moved to New Zealand, it became quite obvious that there was a disconnect based on disciplines, and that there was the marine folks and there was the freshwater folks. And so in some cases, there was these fish that would cross boundaries, migratory fish, and we would know a lot more of one part of their life cycle than we would the other. And so from then, I started to realize that there could be, you know, great utility and opportunities to work across disciplines. And so that I think a paradigm shift I'd like to see in the fisheries profession is just taking advantage of working across disciplines and really leveraging interdisciplinary approaches to understanding fish and appreciating them as part of a much larger system, and that we could benefit from geologists, we can benefit from social scientists, you know, the list goes on and on. And I think that and what I'd really like to see is really a larger emphasis on the social component. And, you know, I'm very appreciative of my training, but a lot of my undergrad and graduate work was really focused on the fish themselves. And sometimes almost looking at, and this may sound harsh, but as anglers or people as a nuisance variable. You know, we know they're there and they're affecting the fish, but we really don't want to deal with them. And so we're going to study the fish themselves and kind of explain, you know, patterns and changes in their environment, but kind of ignoring a huge component of the system. And so one of the paradigms that I'd like to challenge and see a change is sort of the way that we approach fishery science. And I think there's a lot of great work going on in this arena, certainly, but I think we can do better. And I'm hoping to be part of that, you know, sort of paradigm shift in the profession.
Wow, that was an absolutely fantastic answer. And you couldn't be, you know, more correct. And one way that that was sort of revealed to me is actually coming out to Idaho and starting to dip my toes into the anadromous world. And so, you know, growing up in the Southeast, well, historically we would have, you know, striped bass runs, but the major watershed closest to me, the Savannah River watershed, had various dams along it, and that sort of life history for stripers was sort of lost. And so it's just not really something that's really hammered into to folks in that area, or at least in my experience. And then obviously doing my graduate work in the Midwest, working on resident trout that are in, you know, headwater streams, again, it's just not necessarily something that I really spent a lot of time trying to expand my horizons on. But when you come out here and then you start, you know, working in fisheries, if you're not sort of in that language and, you know, knowing all the acronyms and the run timings and how all that works, and, you know, you have to sort of know about, you know, saltwater and the freshwater, sort of their life history, that was the first time where it really hit home to me. I was like, wow, I've never really spent time trying to connect those two systems. So when you started talking about that example, I was like, wow, this is so perfect. That was a great answer.
Well, appreciate it.
Now the tough part of the interview is over, although some people say that this next question is the hardest question of every interview. It's on to our final set of questions that we ask each of our guests. And we start off with some people's least favorite question to answer. And I'm going to hold my assumption here on what your answer is going to be, given, you know, your son's name. But what is your favorite fish?
Yeah, so surprisingly, it is not the Xander or walleye. I'd have to say, and can I pick two possibly, one in the northern hemisphere, one in the southern?
I'd say those rules apply, absolutely.
All right, so perfect. So I'd say smallmouth bass would be my favorite in the northern hemisphere. There's just nothing better than catching smallmouth, and I've had a lot of fun catching them. And I also was able to work on them as part of my master's project, so that was a lot of fun. And so both from a personal and scientific standpoint. And then in the southern hemisphere, the Inanga, the fish that I worked on in New Zealand, it was so amazing, the life history and the life cycle of that fish, on how it evolved and adapted and that it still persists. And so just amazing how these little larvae go out to the ocean and somehow find their way back and to complete their life cycle in the freshwater environment.
Do you have a dream job if you're not already doing it, or potentially a dream location? Or if both those boxes are already checked, is there anywhere else that you'd like to live? And I'll put it with the stamp of places you haven't lived already, because it sounds like that New Zealand stint was pretty awesome.
Yeah, definitely. And this is a tough question, of course. And where you live, there's no perfect place, right? And it's also a multidimensional. And as I've grown older and now have a family, those things change through time. And so we're extremely happy to be here in North Dakota, and the job has been great, and my sons have been enjoying it, and so has my wife. And so I can't think of a better place to live at this time. Granted, we haven't lived here for a full year yet, and so maybe chat with me in a couple years and I can give you a better perspective.
Sounds perfect. And then lastly, if there was one point or principle that you would have hopefully programmed in everyone's head that would listen to this episode, maybe one lasting message for our audience today, what would that be?
Yeah, so I would say embrace change and opportunities, and look for the silver lining. And I would say my life and where I ended up now, I would have never predicted it. And there was a lot of bumps along the way, but those provided opportunities to rethink or challenge the way that I thought of things before. And so there's always a silver lining. Sometimes it's harder to tell, where that is. But I think there's a lot of good things that go along with embracing change and looking for those opportunities during, challenging moments in your life.
Well, just another one of your great wisdom takeaways from today's episode. So, I'd really truly like to thank you for being a guest on the show. I enjoy each of my interviews, and it's always nice to be able to connect with new fishy folks that I haven't in the past. But, if people wanted to connect with you or your work, maybe where are some places they could find you? And I know you mentioned your Google Scholar profile, so maybe that might be the best place, but anywhere else?
Yeah, you can find me on the website, the UND Biology Department website, and then also a Twitter at @LabUnderwater.
Great. Well, I'll be sure to put your Twitter handle and any other relevant links in today's show notes. And with that, I'd just like to say thanks once again for being a guest on the show.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me, Brett. Really appreciate it.
Thank you to everyone for listening to the 107th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at @BBK_95 or any of us co-hosts at Fisheries Pod. On Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or send us an old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. Once again, I really hope that you guys enjoyed this episode. I know that I did. And if you want to listen to any past episodes, you can download them. And in addition to present and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And please don't forget to head over to our Patreon page if you'd like to support the podcast. I'm Brett Kelly, and thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, embrace change and opportunity, and don't forget to look for the silver lining.